Welcome to Liars League, where writers write, actors read, audience listens, and everybody wins. Space is big. Really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. You may think it's a long way to the Phoenix, but that's just peanuts compared to how far and wide the Liars have cast their net to bring you five cosmic tales, five stories of the vast distances between... I'm sorry. My notes say between Brexit and Remain. But that's surely a mistake, as that's from the previous Liars theme, Before and After. And the whole Brexit debacle is now firmly... ongoing, apparently. It may not be infinite, but it's certainly beginning to feel like it. Anyway, tonight we do tackle infinity and beyond, celebrating 50 years since man first set foot on the moon in our never-ending search for intelligent life somewhere out in space, because there's bigger all down here on Earth. At least I think that was an I. It could have been a U. We'll have three space opera epics in the first half, followed by an interval, and then, assuming we all survive re-entry, the infamous Liars League book quiz, and two final frontier stories. In space, no one can hear your ringtones. Downstairs at the Phoenix, however, it's best to turn them off or to silent. And we'll begin. Our first story of the evening will be Proxima Centauri by Oliver Parks, read by Greg Page. This is Oliver's first successful piece after defeating the twin demons of procrastination and having a job. He's been long-listed for the Lincoln Performing Arts Centre's Script This and was an honourable mention in New York City's Midnight 2018 Flash Fiction Competition. He also likes long walks on the beach. A critic once compared Greg Page to the late Sir Alec Guinness. He said, "Guinness was a much better actor." Undaunted, Greg recently appeared at the National Theatre, directed by Sam Mendes. No, really. He'll never forget what Mendes said to him. He said, "Stand there." Greg!
Proxima Centauri by Oliver Parks. The toolbox clattered as Jim flung himself down the hallway. He had to fix the hole in the roof or else he'd run out of oxygen and die. Again. Oxygen levels depleting. Please report to the impact site immediately. It was good to hear the computer again, Jim thought. When the debris struck the ship, the whole system had gone quiet. He placed the sheet of metal over the hole and, gloveless, used the blowtorch to weld the two together. He only had a little training from Daniels, who seemed to have a toolbox permanently attached to the end of his arm. Jim had been a surgeon on Earth, so at least he had a steady hand. The pull of the vacuum wasn't quite enough to drag him out into space, as the ship's gravity well had increased to keep him on board, but his hair still fluttered in the escaping air. His concentration lapsed for a moment. He was thinking of the next step, whether to stop the fire himself or let the ship's suppression system handle it, and he cut through his finger. It was unbearably painful, but at least it had cauterized itself. Soon the ship's hull was fixed and the gravity restored to Earth standard. Jim's ears had popped during the change in pressure and his left hand throbbed incessantly. Jim jogged through the hall to the garden, where the fire had started. The debris that hit the ship had short-circuited several systems, setting fire to some of the plants, He could let the fire suppression system deal with it, but the foam would do untold damage to the plants, and he couldn't have that. Priority number one was oxygen. The garden was more of a field with plants in rows. Only one row was currently on fire. Areca palms. It meant the ship's oxygen would take a hit. The rest of the crew were already dead. Daniels and McCrory had been sucked out of the hull breach before the ship had protected itself. Adams was working on a hydroponic light in the garden when the debris struck and she fell. Her ladder was still there with her body by the side of it. He had to fix things himself until the others got back. He dropped the toolbox and pulled the fire extinguisher from a nearby wall, wincing at the pain in his hand. The smoke was beginning to fill the room, choking Jim's throat. His eyes watered. But through the tears, he carefully sprayed the quickly disintegrating plants with foam. The fire subdued, Jim sat wheezing on the ladder, his head light from lack of air. He wiped his eyes with the back of his sleeve, smearing his face with grease. He surveyed the destruction. It would take time, he saw, but it could be fixed. Their food was mostly safe, and... But the thought was cut short as the broken light fell and smashed Jim's head with a crack. The whole process is a lot like being hungover. At first, there's a darkness, confusion, not quite knowing where or who you are. And then the world expands into a blinding light as the memory implant kicks in. Your head shoots with pain and flickers. Vaguely recognised memories dance behind your eyes. This was not the first time Jim had woken up as a clone. All the crew of TerraCore's debut voyage had been through the process. It was a necessity before you left Earth. Jim stepped out of the cubicle into the medbay. He looked at himself in the mirror. It was always a good idea to check there weren't any mistakes. "Good morning, Dr. Hastings," came a voice from above. "Welcome back. It is currently 8:28 a.m. ship time. Would you like coffee?" Jim nodded. It was all the computer needed. In a nearby hole in the wall, a plastic cup plopped into place and was filled with a viscous brown liquid. Jim picked it up in his newly unburnt hand. "Milk and sugar, just as you like it." The coffee tasted bitter. They'd long since run out of sugar. "Computer, where are the rest of the crew?" "McCrory and Daniels are in the main hallway. Adams is in the garden. Would you like me to contact them?" "I must already be back," Jim thought. "No, thank you." He walked through the matte white halls to the same spot the hull had been breached. Where Jim had welded the roof shut was now perfectly smooth, the ship having fixed it properly. And there was no indication that there had ever been a problem. Jim looked up and down the hallway. "Computer, where are Daniels and McCrory?"
"Right next to you, Doctor."
Jim turned around, half expecting them to be behind him, but he was alone. "They're not here."
"I'm afraid I don't understand," was the ship's reply.
An uneasy feeling sat in Jim's stomach. "Is Adams still in the garden?"
"Yes."
He walked briskly through the corridor, trying to look nonchalant, as if the ship could tell what he was thinking, and stepped into the garden. The room was warm, as it always was, but clean of smoke, the air having cycled through the air purifiers. But there was no sign of Adams. "She's still in here? Right now?" The computer paused for a moment, as if in thought.
"Approximately 30 meters ahead of you."
Jim looked. There stood the ladder that Adams and Jim himself had died on. He walked to it, picked up the toolbox, and carried it back to the medbay, of which the cloning station was a significant part.
"Well, if you can't fix it, you can always start again,"
Adams had joked, patting the cloning capsule door. He inspected the screen on the wall, which displayed the current status, location and runtime of each of the four-person crew. Apparently, they had all been active for several months, apart from Jim, whose runtime was less than an hour. The clone station consisted of four pods, the other side of a capsule around the size of a shower cubicle. When a crew member died, his or her clone would be brought into the capsule, where their memories would be uploaded through a port built into the back of their head, creating a near seamless continuation of life. In the meantime, a new clone would be grown to lessen their downtime. In case of death, break glass, Adams had written on the cubicle in permanent marker. Using the touchscreen, Jim navigated to the crew's log, which kept tabs on any and all activity. It could be briefly stopped if the crew wanted a private moment, as the ship put it, but otherwise it constantly monitored heart rate, blood and vitals, you name it. He pulled up the file on Adams. There was no record of her death, only that she'd been sent to the garden to fix some lights. It was the same with McCrory and Daniels. Jim realised that all of the crew but himself had died while the ship's computer was offline, so there was no record of any death other than his own. And the computer wouldn't bring them back unless it sensed their death, not just their body. He had to convince the computer to revive them. Computer, patch me through to the crew. Affirmative. A pause. I'm sorry, I can't seem to reach them now. Would you like me to try again? No. You can't reach them because they aren't here. They're dead. You need to bring them back. I'm afraid I don't understand. Adams, McCrory, and Daniels, bring them back. I don't understand. Try rephrasing the question. Jim closed his eyes, thought for a moment. He retraced through his memories to their training. Activate Nine Lives protocol subjects McCrory, Adams, Daniel. Password? Lazarus. A pause again. Denied. Under Law 22B, no two clones can support the same consciousness. His body tense, Jim walked to the cubicle, pressed his face to the glass, cold against his burning head. Through the other side, he could see the four clone pods, one empty, three with naked forms within. He would have to restart them manually, and as the ship didn't understand, he would have to break through to the clones. Jim reached into the toolbox, picked out a crowbar, and smashed through the centre of Adam's message, sending glass shards across the floor. The lights strobed red in the semi-darkness. Dr. Hastings, the computer spoke, your actions are in direct contradiction of ship's guideline 9, 6, and 23. Cease immediately. Jim stepped into the cubicle, ducked under the memory implant cable, and smashed through the second glass door. You have been warned. Under ship guideline 32A, I am authorized to apply a deterrent. Please assume a seated position, as this will prevent injury. A dull ache began to spread through Jim's head from the implant port on the back of his skull, which vibrated like a bass speaker. The shock sent him tumbling into the clone bay, sprawling into the broken glass. Jim picked himself up, teeth gritted, and pushed himself up to one of the occupied cubicles. The name on the top read McCrory in engraved letters. He searched fruitlessly for a handle or button to open the door, his head throbbing. Instead, he brought the crowbar up and against the side of the pod again and again until the glass cracked and then shattered, sending more shards of glass and gallons of liquid across the room. He dragged the body through the fluid and broken glass to the cubicle. Dr. Hastings, you are in direct violation of Earth law. Cease immediately or face termination. Jim knew it wouldn't be permanent, as killing clones was illegal, and he wasn't willing to give up. He pulled the dead weight into the cubicle, his arms burning and sweat beading on his forehead. He pulled the memory cord, hoisted McGrory up until he nearly had the cable in the socket, but the cord disappeared, sucked up into the cubicle roof, and the hole sealed behind it. He cried out in anguish. Dr. Hastings, you are to be terminated immediately. His cries turned to screams of pain as something squelched behind his eyes and his vision went black.
Good afternoon, Jim. Ship time is 3:52 p.m. Would you like coffee?
A cup popped into existence in the wall.
How long? 3 weeks and 2 days. I've had the place cleaned for your arrival.
Jim sipped his coffee, deep in thought.
I have some bad news. Adams, McCrory and Daniels are missing.
Missing? Jim replied. Missing where?
I'm afraid I don't understand. Without a log of their deaths, I am unable to clone their consciousnesses lawfully.
Just me and you then, Jim thought. He checked the screen and, sure enough, their names had simply missing displayed next to them.
We have 6 months until we reach Proxima Centauri, where we can contact Earth once terraforming begins. Until then, there is much to do. Let's get started, shall we?
Finally, the day came. Jim had watched as the dot in the distance became a star, and then he saw the speck of the planet slowly become a distant orb.
We will begin our descent in approximately 1 hour. All crew, please make your way to the observation deck.
Jim headed to the front of the ship, which was all but covered in screens of the exterior view from the bow. He saw the planet, tantalizingly close. The computer would control the descent as it had controlled their journey the whole way from Earth, where the original estimated coordinates had been entered. It was only possible to control the ship in case of emergency. Jim watched as the distance counter decreased towards zero. But then the planet began to drift on the screen, off to the right.
Computer, we're going to miss the planet. I'm afraid I don't understand.
We need to adjust course, engage manual steering, password Argo. 2 control units sprang out of the wall on either side of the room.
Please enter access codes.
Jim's blood turned to ice. I can't enter 2 codes. There's only 1 of us left.
Under ship guideline 47, 2 crew members must authorize any change in direction. The ship will now continue its course.
The 2 control units snapped back into the wall, and Jim was left uselessly staring at the screens surrounding him. After a few minutes, the distance counter stopped dropping, halted, and began to increase again. The planet grew smaller and smaller as Jim watched it until it became a dot in the distance behind them. He turned and looked ahead into the depths of space. He saw the journey stretch out ahead of him, infinite clones continuing his miserable existence. He wondered how long it would be before he reached a planet, then considered how improbable it was, a fraction dwindling towards nothing. Jim could wait. He had to. He had nothing but time.
Second story will be London 2025 by Wang Xinfa, read by Cliff Chapman. One is a character and three Chinese characters. Cliff's credits include Dirk Mag's new Audible adaptation of Alien 3 by William Gibson, Blake 7, and Pathfinder Legends for Big Finish, and over 20 roles for Games Workshop's Black Library, available on CD, download, and Audible. He's currently directing Alan Ayckbourn's Communicating Doors at the Gaiety Theatre, Isle of Man. Cliff!
London 2025 by Wan Xinfar. Others might remember things differently, but if you ask me, something changed after he started time travelling. That's not to say there was a clean break between before and after. I think he took it up because he needed something new in his life, something to give him a bit of a jolt, to broaden his horizons. A lot of us need that these days. But I reckon that's when things started to get worse. I remember the first time he didn't even tell me. He said he was going to China, but not the Yangtze Valley in 1931. Maybe he wasn't going to say anything at all. He was always a very private person. But when he returned, he couldn't contain it. The crazy thing is how similar it is, he said, drumming his long fingers across the crumbs on our shared kitchen table. Like, I know this sounds kind of dumb, but the past doesn't feel like it's the past. You expect it's going to be, I don't know, black and white, or it'll somehow feel far away and faded and historical. But it just feels like this. Like you and me here. It was nice to see him with a renewed energy, though it seemed tinged with a sense of agitation or urgency. It was one of those long summer evenings when it feels like the sun might rest just below the horizon forever, and I remember searching for his eyes as they darted around in the darkening honey light. He was more or less the same after that trip, I'd say. Maybe in retrospect a little more absent-minded than usual, but he was definitely weird after the next journey. That was to Andhra Pradesh, 1839. The morning he returned, I found him lying on the sofa, staring at his reflection in the cracked screen on his phone. His carefully labelled luggage sat obediently by him on the floor, its glittering biometric tags hanging off its body like alien earrings. I was excited to hear what he'd seen and who he'd met. I threw questions at him, but the moment he sat up, he looked exhausted. He'd start a sentence like a bird trying to take flight. Well, yeah, it was... So I guess... But then stumbled back down. This was not completely out of character. It had always been difficult to get him to open up. But it was unusual. I kept trying, though, and I asked him something I thought would be easier for him to talk about, just to get going. The logistics of it all. I knew some stuff about time travelling, of course, from seeing adverts and following some of the ground protests back when the tech went public. I still see occasional thought broadcasts about it in my timelines, too. The ones I subscribe to always refer to it disparagingly as apocalypse tourism, because they only send people to places days before some kind of catastrophe happened. Some biblical-sized flood, or cyclone, or earthquake. That's the only way they can ensure travellers don't leave any kind of mark and inadvertently change the course of history. But I was curious about how it all actually works as a tourist. The companies behind it always emphasise how closely regulated the industry is, but some say that's bullshit. There are rumours, for example, that people are simply let loose once they reach the destinations and that every now and then a traveller just forgets to return home. Well, I mean, it's hard to keep track of everyone, probably, but I've never heard of anyone not returning, he said, finally engaging. And you can't really forget to come back. They signal you really clearly 48 hours before, you know, whatever's about to happen. They make a mark in the sky, the kind of thing you wouldn't ordinarily notice, that you pass off as a weird cloud or something, except they drill it into you constantly during the training. You're kind of scared you'll miss it, but then when you see it, it's really obvious. I was pleased I got him to talk at least a little, but I hope that might be the end of his time-travelling trips. They seem to take something out of him. A couple of months later, however, he told me he was going to Aleppo, 1138. This time, it was much worse. He came back with scabs like ragged craters along his jaw and knuckles like red rope. I found him staring at his hands in the living room. I asked him if he was okay, but got nothing in response. I asked him what he'd seen on the trip, what the air smelled like, how the water tasted that long ago. He looked me up and down vacantly like I was an old piece of furniture he was half considering buying. It was only when I put my hand on his shoulder that he really seemed to see me. I asked him again how it had been. Oh, yeah. It was kind of amazing, he said hesitantly, as if disagreeing with his own choice of words. There was this kid. Oh, such a smart, sweet kid. His family took me in. I'm not sure why, but they invited me to eat with them these huge meals every evening. I felt kind of bad, but then the food was going to go to waste any time pretty soon. I mean, I know that sounds cold, but, well, he breathed in and paused, a half-formed thought dancing invisibly in front of us. For so long, I wasn't sure he was still going to speak. I gave him space and let his silence fill the room. So wild living when you know none of it matters, he continued softly after a few moments, that your footprints, all the footprints, will be completely washed away. His voice faded into the carpet until it felt as if the drumbeat from the flat below had crept up like a rising tide and subsumed us. But they have no idea what's about to happen, he whispered as if to himself. You feel so sorry for them. He never told me what happened in Aleppo 1138, and for the following few weeks I didn't see much of him. When I did see him, it felt like his mind was fixed on something far off in the distance, or perhaps on nowhere at all. If we were both in the flat, we'd sometimes sit together, not really talking. I wasn't sure if he cared, or half the time noticed I was there or not, but then once or twice I caught him staring at me with this deep, pitying look. At one point, I decided that I should tell him to stop time-travelling, that I thought it was no good for him. I figured I might as well try to say something, but then our paths never crossed for long enough, or it never felt like the right moment. Then a couple of weeks later, I came home to find a note on the kitchen table. He'd gone to Hiroshima, 1945. After that trip, he was even more distant. I could only tell he'd been home if he left a tap running or if I spotted the remains of a takeaway meal on his bedroom floor. Once I pushed his door open and saw his guitar bent out of shape like an old man, its neck splintered and its body only held together by the metal strings. When I confronted him, he looked puzzled. Why does it matter? He asked with what seemed like genuine curiosity, gazing benevolently at me as if I was a child. Then I didn't see him at all for about a month. I tried calling him, but with no luck. Our friends tried to reassure me. He'd always needed his own space, and people go AWOL a lot these days, they said. But this was a long time for someone to be out of contact. I was starting to get properly worried, wondering what I should do, until he turned up again yesterday out of the blue. He was just there, sitting in the sunlit living room, rotating the broken guitar in his hands and grinning at it like it was some great riddle to solve. He looked tired and yet somehow brighter and more awake than I'd seen him for months. His cheeks had picked up some of the yellow from the sun. He hugged me. I wanted to ask him how he was and where he'd been, but I didn't want to break the spell and risk him retreating back into himself, so I acted like everything was normal. I suggested that, since it was such a nice day, we take advantage and go for a walk on the heath like we used to. He said it was one of the best ideas he'd ever had. We talked intermittently about not very much as we walked up the hill. Flowers, birds, drones, funny dogs that ran across our path, before reaching the summit, where we sat overlooking London in the warm breeze. I figured he must have started taking some kind of medication or getting therapy, but decided not to ask him just yet. Now he seems so much better, though, I realised there was so much else I wanted to talk to him about. How it feels to time travel, to live with people with no purpose in a world you know is about to be destroyed. Whether he was still planning to do more trips. They say they're adding new destinations all the time, and they're getting more and more recent. Beira, 2019. Tuvalu, Chittagong, Port Louis, 2020. I wanted to tell him I'd missed him, that I'd been worrying about him. But I held my tongue. The moment felt too delicate, and I figured there'd be plenty of other chances to talk, or at least that's what I told myself. Either way, I was wrong. I didn't know if he was pretending to be better for my sake, but just as I was about to suggest we keep moving, having run our fingers through the cool grass long enough, he jumped up and pointed into the distance beyond the wind turbines. "There you go," he said, wide-eyed and beaming. "There, the funny curve on the horizon where the orange meets the green. You see it? It looks like it's shimmering, like a giant fish scale, but if you keep your eye on it, you'll see it's not actually changing at all. 48 hours, that means. I told you it was obvious. Why aren't you looking?" He turned and stared at me, his brow crumpling slowly in confusion and then disappointment, like I was the crazy one for refusing to stand up and follow his outstretched finger. I couldn't move or speak. It took every bit of willpower just to look back at him. We held each other's gaze for what felt like an age. Brothers in arms and strangers at the same time, tears collecting faster than words ever would, before he shook his head, bowed at me oddly, and then hurried away. I don't know where he went, but he didn't come home last night, and half his stuff is gone.
Thank you, Cliff. The third story, and the last one before the interval, will be How to Be an Astronaut by Alice Franklin, read by Gloria Sands. Alice is a London-based intern, hammock enthusiast and writer. Previously, her work has appeared in the Financial Times and three Spanish language anthologies. From September, she will be studying for an MA in creative writing at the UEA. Gloria trained at Drama Studio London. She regularly narrates audiobooks for the RNIB and recently joined the cast of Time Will Tell's Dracula at Whitby Abbey. She often works as a historical interpreter at heritage sites around the country and has continued her training in clowning and historical fooling. Gloria!
How to Be an Astronaut by Alice Franklin. 1. Read. You are young when you start reading books about space. Event horizons, the Oort cloud, and the Kuiper belt enter your lexicon long before you learn to spell the word exhilarating, accelerate, or happiness. Your school doesn't allow you to write in pen. They're not even teaching physics. My very easy method just shows us 9 planets was something you learned when you were 3. And when you were 4, you learnt it was false. By 7, Pluto is not a planet, miss, you say. Yes, it is, the teacher says. Pluto is most definitely a planet. It says so in your textbook. The textbook is 20 years old, which means it's 13 years older than you, which means it is shit. 2. Dream. You can't sleep. Tomorrow is your 9th birthday and you have asked Mum and Dad for a telescope. You can't wait to unwrap the box, assemble the parts, inspect the mirror, to turn your gaze to the moon. In the morning, you get a book. Stars you can see with the naked eye. A NASA t-shirt and chocolate. You hug your mum and dad and go upstairs to cry as quietly as you can. When night falls, you go into the garden and lie on the grass. It is already damp with dew and it soaks your new t-shirt. Through the haze of light pollution, you see Polaris, Sirius, and Betelgeuse, but not much else. You look at the moon. Its light gives off a green and yellow glow. You are enchanted. You are sad. 3. Read. You are 11 when you start reading Kurt Vonnegut, Philip K. Dick, Douglas Adams. You could never stand the books on the school syllabus, so every week your dad takes you to the local library where you sit and read whilst he does the shopping, takes a walk, or whatever it is he does when you're at the library. You learn about aliens. You learn about time travel. You learn about teleporting. You learn how to spell exhilarating, accelerate, and happiness. It's very exciting. And in the evening, you write stories which are basically poor remakes of what you've read during the day. At night, you stay awake, staring at the ceiling. You can't wait to grow up. 4. Train. You climb onto the roof to see if you can handle the vertigo, because you imagine astronauts who orbit the Earth at 240 miles above the ground on the International Space Station experience intense vertigo. You stand on a second floor window ledge, grip the gutter, and clamber up. Oh, you don't mind the height at all. You find it exhilarating. From here, you can see the park, your school, and the church. You stay for a while, wondering how you're going to get back down. After a while, you start to panic. How are you going to get back down? Eventually, you message your mum. She freaks out. She shouts, cries, swears, all things you have never heard or seen her do before. The farmer comes around with a large ladder. When he arrives, you see him shaking his head. You need to call the fire brigade, he says. They arrive with blue lights. They are wearing fancy uniforms. They carry you down in a fireman's lift. I'm not angry, your mum says over dinner. I'm just embarrassed. 5. Read. You are 13 when you start reading books on physics. You learn then that science is more interesting than science fiction. You learn that the entire human race could fit inside a sugar cube. You learn about white holes. You learn that a spacesuit costs £9 million. This is long before you have learnt the meaning of the words analytics, optimise, or benchmark. At night you barely sleep. You are too busy reading. 6. Send in a speculative application. Dear sir/madam, I am an astronaut. I am unafraid of heights. I have climbed onto the roof of my house and was absolutely fine. I am in perfect physical health. I've never had a single thing wrong with me except for scarlet fever, which went away after a couple of weeks and didn't leave any scars. I don't have anything wrong with me psychiatrically either. I've never been depressed or anxious or manic or psychotic. My reflexes are Good. If you throw a ball at me, I'll catch it. I can run for 2 hours without stopping. I know the names of loads of the stars you can see with the naked eye. I am predicted A's in maths and physics and chemistry and biology and even English and art. I don't drink or smoke or take drugs except paracetamol. I have been following every single NASA mission for 6 years and know a great deal about your organisation. Please write back to me if you'd like to interview me. I'd love to join your team. 7. Train. You can do 20 press-ups now. You can lift half your body weight. Your team at school smashes every opponent, and that's mostly because of you. You get your school to start doing rugby for the girls and quickly become captain. People call you big, huge, the monster girl. You don't care. You're training. You enroll onto the RAF cadets. You fly.
Oh, the pilot takes over and does a loop the loop. You can't stop grinning.
You've never felt so free. 8. Dream. All the good aeronautical engineering courses require 3 A's, and you've got 3 B's. So you decide to take a gap year, retake your exams, and try again. At night, you barely sleep, dreaming about Machu Picchu, Incan kings, campuses with cloisters, libraries that go on forever. 9. Get close to the stars. You are on an island in Lake Titicaca, Bolivia. You are nearly 4,000 metres above sea level. It's difficult to breathe. You pant, sweat, complain. There are no cars, so you have to walk everywhere or take a horse, for which the locals charge a relative fortune. When it gets dark, it's time to go to bed, because there's no electricity. You're walking back to your hut when your friend grabs you by the arm. Look up, she says, look up now. You frown at her before doing what she says.
The sky is enormous, bigger than any sky you've seen before. It stretches from horizon to horizon, every single millimetre punctuated with thousands of stars. You feel like you're falling into it. It's not just the altitude that takes your breath away. Polaris, Sirius, Betelgeuse, you say. But you've forgotten the names for the other stars, the other galaxies you can see, and so stop there. What are you saying? Nothing, you say. I'm saying nothing.
Dream. 10. You are sitting on the balcony, smoking with a co-worker. What did you want to be when you were younger? You ask.
Did you always want to be a social media executive?
Kind of, he says. I did get on Twitter when I was 7. There is a pause. What about you? You mull this over a while. What did you want to be when you were young? A police officer, you say. I just love those cop shows. Huh? He says, what happened to that dream? You shrug. It went away, you say. To be honest, I don't really know what I want to be. Maybe an astronaut. He laughs.
Go for it.
Reach for the stars. You take another drag and watch the smoke float up into the sky. You live in London, where there are no stars. Nah, you say. I'm all right.
Thank you, Gloria. And that concludes our first stage separation. You may now begin your EVA, or if you've forgotten your spacesuit and have a valid note from a guardian of the galaxy, Sit around instead and discuss the planetary status of Pluto as we refuel. Stage 2 will commence in about 20 minutes. As we stare into the black depths of the cosmos, we know that the cosmos is staring back. But we still can't see you as well as you can see us. So if you think you know the answer, stick your hand in the air and shout, "Live long and prosper." Practice session?
Do I have to do it like that?
But they, no. They can do it. However they can.
Bonus points if you can do that.
1, 2, 3.
Live long and prosper!
Right, let's introduce the books.
Okay. Our first book is a classic by a well-known science fiction author, Ian M. Banks, not Ian Banks, completely different identity, Use of Weapons, a culture novel.
The
well, answer a question, maybe you'll get it. The man known as Chiradanine should have practiced this Zakal way.
Yeah, no, it's not easy. You just read it and then you kind
of
go
there's
just
one
of over it a little bit.
Special circumstances for most agents, changing the destiny of planets to suit the culture through intrigue, dirty tricks, or military action. Find out about his adventures if you win this book. A non-fiction, possibly, addition to our book pile is An Optimist Tour of the Future by Mark Stevenson, in which one curious man sets out to answer, through science interviews and speculation, what's next? Sneaking in with a lunar title in the literary fiction department is The Almost Moon, by Alice Sebold, the author of The Lovely Bones. When all is said and done, says the back cover, killing my mother came easily. We've all been there. And finally, perhaps the star prize in the firmament is Weird Lies, which is Liesleaf's very own award-winning anthology of science fiction, fantasy, horror, and weird fiction. And if you're not lucky or clever enough to win a copy, there are more available for the not very princely sum of £5, which is 50% off the cover price, over at the Dusk. So,
come to see us after the show if you want one of those. Right, let's crack on with the questions. I hope everyone remembers how to answer. Yeah. Right, question 1. Who wrote the 1901 published novel, The First Men in the Moon?
Herndon and Prosper.
Oh, almost, yes.
Is that H.G. Wells?
Yes, it was.
Good guess. 1901, an 01 science fiction author writing that. Not War of the Worlds. Good, well done. What would you like?
Oh, Ian Banks, please.
Which one?
Ian and Banks.
Oh, good choice.
I have already bought Weird Lives. I've read it, it's very good.
That's my favourite Ian Banks, so...
Oh, it's very, very good.
Question 2. What is the name of Anne Leckie's Hugo, Nebula and Arthur C. Clarke winning 2013 published debut science fiction novel?
I think I know this.
What's the name of the...
Name of Anne Leckie's Hugo, Nebula and Arthur C. Clarke winning 2013 published debut science fiction novel.
Any lucky fans?
We have to move on.
We might.
Prosper.
Oh, yeah.
Brian.
It's not the correct answer, but it was worth a guess.
Good guess.
And I'm closer than the rest.
You are indeed.
I'm Brian and so is my wife.
No, there's no clue for a type of a novel. I can get. Yeah,
are you going to tell them the answer?
I'm going to give you the answer, though.
Rush out by it.
If anyone has... Ancillary Justice.
Now, you're... I was like, oh! Ancillary Justice.
It's a good thing we've got spare.
We have.
I'm not
spare
sure,
questions.
I'm not sure this is going to go any better. Let's see.
Okay.
Because it's another 2013. In which 2013 YA novel by Sally Gardner does an alternative history Britain attempt to fake a moon landing.
Oh! I read it a couple of months ago. Something about rats. It's got rats in it. They're not proper rat something. Rat moon?
That's not quite enough. Yeah, right. It does have the word moon in the title. I'll give you that much.
Rat in the moon. Button moon. Just keep going.
Keep going with the live long and prosper, so anybody?
Rotten
moon. Close. Oh. It's close.
Should we go there? It's.
Have you actually read it?
I've read it.
He really has. I'm really bad remembering titles and novels.
Let's give it to him. It is. Maggot moon.
So close.
And again, it's a great read as well. Which of the books would you like?
You can have half a book.
Half a book.
To read it, give it back.
So it's tear it in half. The one with the moon one.
Yep,
moon,
almost the moon.
Another moon project.
There you go. Almost.
Okay, the questions are too hard. I didn't vet them through Katie this time.
Next I'm the question. Normal person who's like, Liam, that is too difficult. But I didn't get them this time. So.
What is the name of the sequel to 2001 A Space Odyssey?
Yes, at the back.
I'll give you that. It's the film title, but 2010 Odyssey 2 is the book title, so that is good enough. Which book would you like?
The Weird Lies.
Good choice. We like you, sir.
For bonus points, what's the third one called? Do you know this?
Odyssey 3.
And what's the year in which it's set?
2061.
And then
the fourth one, which is 3001, but nobody continued to read it after that book. Right, so
last
two questions left, one book left.
Optimist, Tour of the Future, we all need one of these.
Who wrote the 2014 debut novel, A Long Way to a Small Angry Planet?
Can we? Can I improvise one?
I've got one more question.
Oh, okay. All right. It's all right. I've got
anybody?
Again,
it's a debut novel. So, who wrote the 2014 debut novel, A Long Way to a Small Angry Planet? Right. Next question. The answer is Becky Chambers.
Shout out to Becky.
Right. So, which Booker Prize-winning Nigerian-born author wrote the 2007 novel Starbuck?
These pained faces. I can see some of them. Improvised question?
His Booker Prize was for The Famished Road.
Oh, yes. Yes.
It's the correct answer.
Ben Opry. Yay!
Close to the wire.
Was traumatic.
Read more sci-fi.
Read a lot more sci-fi, especially for events like tonight, or for my questions, or for the infamous Lively, whatever. Right, we are going to continue with the second half. So the first story of the second half is The Martlet by Abigail Lee, read by Lois Tucker. Abigail writes a lot and crosses out even more. Their stories, 1,000 Rupees and Miriam's Prayer, have previously been read at Liars League, and she's also publishing class fiction in Noun and X Plus One. She is shirking on a novel. Lois has done various bits and bobs and will probably end up doing more. Previous stuff includes penning and performing 3 solo shows as her silent comedy alter ego, Lois of the Lane. I'm releasing the miscellaneous EP on Bandcamp, which consists of catchy, silly songs. More details at her freshly pimped website, loistucker.net. Lois!
The Martlet by Abigail Lee. Bill went for a walk on Ramsgate Beach before lunch and found a dozen washed-up dogfish, dull grey in death, with down-slit, gurning mouths like sad baby sharks, scattered over the otherwise unblemished sunny sand. It took the gleam off the morning, and they retreated up the zigzagging sea stairs where chalk fell from the paperwhite cliffs and people wrote their names on the concrete. Kerry's work friend, Lowe, exhaustingly playful, grabbed a piece and scrawled their names, the date, and Happy 30th, Kerry! At the rundown Clifftop Cafe, they all bought cheap ice cream and chips. Nobody wanted fish now. Gulls and pigeons, sensing bounty, attacked in waves, and Rachel noticed one scruffy pigeon lingering longer, more exhausted than the others. It had an angry pink bubblegum blob where one of its feet should be, and hobbled about with a theatricality which, in a human, would imply faking. She nudged Duncan. Look, how do you think that happened? He frowned. Ouch, don't know, maybe landing on a train rail or something? Poor bird, she said. Can't walk, can barely fly. Have a chip. She tossed one at its good foot, and the pigeon nodded obsequiously towards it. The martlet from the rental house's crest flitted through her head, footless, restless, ever forward. She ended up giving the cripple pigeon half of her chips out of pity and guilt. But guilt for what? Kerry, queen, a history geek, had explained at length over breakfast how the Victorian architect who built the place, which was basically the Gothic mansion out of the Adams family, secret door and all, had designed his own coat of arms featuring this mythical bird without feet. It flies forever, unable to land, Kerry told them solemnly through sourdough toast. The motto is en avant, forward. Like the Flying Dutchman, Kerry's new boyfriend Mark had smirked. To infinity and beyond! But Mark was a dick. Good thing Rachel only saw the old crowd at Christmas and birthdays. Duncan and Kerry were pretty much the only ones left alike. Being out of the country was a good excuse to avoid the things she didn't want to deal with. This year, Reuters had posted her to Brussels. It was a pretty easy gig. More interesting than Stockholm, when she'd once got an urgent call at 3 a.m. because Sweden had won Olympic bronze in the luge. Less dangerous than Tallinn. Okay, basically. Saturday night, drinking and party games. Kerry was hell-bent on capital F fun, and Mark, the wine buff, cracked out his case of red. Ruby Riojas, Crimson Chiantis, Maroon Merlots. Rachel sipped and studied the crest carved above the fireplace more closely. The martlet bird sat in profile on a shield. Behind it twined stylized ivy on a shaded ground. Sure enough, its legs ended not in clawed feet, but a stubby little three-way stump, like the club in a deck of cards. It looked fine from a distance, if you didn't know what it was, but now she couldn't unsee it. Rachel felt a piercing pang thinking about that poor bird, like when she was premenstrual and could sense the sadness that lay beneath everything, just waiting to be stirred at a touch like mud at the bottom of a still pool. They all drank lengthy invented toasts to the birthday girl, and then Kerry said she wanted to play Murder in the Dark. And even though they were all pushing 30, not 13, it was a party, so. The library was a large, gloomy, high-ceilinged room, wood-panelled and velvet-curtained. After explaining the rules, Kerry flicked off the lights to test the effect. It was utterly dark, a real blackout, the kind where you have to blink to test the black on the inside of your eyelids against the darkness outside them. The kind where you might as well shut your eyes or go blind. And suddenly, Rachel remembered the dream she had last night. Black feathers spiralling like snow out of a starless sky, and the swish and rustle of wings unfolding. A shadow falling across her face, and when she tried to run, her arms were stiff and jointed, no fingers anymore, and her feet were stuck in something. She thought it was mud until she looked down and saw they were gone. And she started to fall, and that was when she woke up, staring in sweating sheets in that cool, drafty maid's room. She stood in the darkness, paralysed. How did she forget that till now? Suddenly the black was pierced by a squealing shriek. Rachel dived for the wall and snapped the lights on to reveal Lo, who was turning out to be a tiresomely excitable drunk. She was clutching Duncan's arm like she just won it at auction. Oh, God, so sorry. I bumped into someone and I just freaked out. Sorry, Dunks. But she didn't let go. Quietly spoken, softly bearded, hipster spectacle Duncan didn't stand a chance against Lowe's determined coquetry, thought Rachel. Mark doled out the cards. Ace was the murderer, Queen the detective. Everyone else was just a victim waiting to happen. Rachel looked at her card. Generic citizen. Oh well. She decided to lie down on one of the large sofas and stay very quiet. Maybe nobody would stumble over her and she could just keep still and think positive thoughts, get through the next few minutes. She got anxious in the dark sometimes, but she never told anyone because it was the second most pathetic thing to be scared of in the whole pantheon of fail phobias just behind mice. The lights went out. She steeled herself, breathing evenly, fumbled her way to the sofa and lay down, barely daring to move. The muffled slide and stumble of hesitant feet on the thick carpet loomed closer, then faded. Slow breathing on her left, slight nose whistle like the flute of a bird behind and above. Someone between the sofa and the bookshelf. She pressed herself further into the cushions and stopped her breath. Still nobody was dead. The victim was meant to count to three, then scream. At last, the heavy breather passed on and her heart hurtled so hard in relief she could almost hear it battering inside her chest. Or was that an actual sound? Soft at first, a sort of fluttering struggle. What was it? Something trapped? A mouse? A rat? Muffled thudding like a tiny fist against wood. Too near. Rachel counted. Ignored it. She was hearing things. Why won't somebody die? The thick silence surged up, filled her ears like sea foam, then suddenly wings were beating next to her head, horribly close. The scrape and flap right under her, beneath the sofa. A bird must have got in, trapped and suffocating. Rachel sat up and screamed. Matey applause and a scramble for the light switch. Mark flipped it on. Standing in the middle of the room was Lo in the act of tapping Duncan on the shoulder, both of them looking stunned and guilty. So what? Lo's the killer, pouted Kerry, confused. Did you scream, Dunks? You're supposed to count three. No, sorry, it was me. Rachel's voice was high and tight in her chest, not enough air in her lungs. Stupid, stupid, it's only a bloody bird, probably terrified out of its mind. What? Did you kill Rachel, Lo? If looks could, she would now. No. I think there's a bird stuck under the sofa, Rachel gasped. Sorry, it surprised me, I screamed. But there was nothing under the sofa, or anywhere else. They all hunted enthusiastically, thrilled by this potential diversion, then bored and annoyed. Quoth the raven, nevermore, said Mark as he opened the writing desk drawer sarcastically. Maybe it was a ghost bird. Nobody's heart was in the game after that, and Rachel felt the smart of shame. She slipped out to check her emails on her phone. News never slept, and her editor didn't seem to recognise the concept of annual leave. Returning, she found Mark and Kerry snuggled smug, and Lo leaning into Duncan, tits cocked, determined. One couple and one waiting to happen. Rachel curled in a reading chair and watched them swirl and flip through the library like fish in a tank or swifts in flight. They didn't seem to notice she wasn't joining in as they played student classics, Truth or Dare, Spin the Bottle, really, retreating into adolescence as the night advanced. Eventually the fun dwindled like the snapping fire until only Lo and Duncan were still playing a game they'd invented, drinking with Cluedo. Rachel tried to join in for a while before she made one too many wrong guesses and had to drink more than she wanted and started to feel like her feet were very far away and hard to steer. As 2 a.m. struck and Kerry lay passed out on the chaise longue, Mark offered to see her up the town room stairs. Fancied being alone up here, eh? Said Mark. It's nice, a little eerie, a little nest. Good for a bird of passage like you. He crinkled his eyes. He meant well. Hope you weren't too dull compared to your journo pals. No, not at all. Glamorous foreign correspondent, a boy in every port. He was pretty drunk. Drunker than she'd thought. Lucky you. Free as a bird. But he didn't know about the panic attacks. About lying in bed at 4 a.m. in yet another rented flat in another new city where everything's familiarly different again. The money, the language, the job, the life. Standing stone still in a locked bathroom for an hour, terrified the noise from the kitchen is someone breaking in to kill her. He doesn't know she's tried to put down roots, but they never take. But the thing that she's most afraid of is this, that medieval image she heard once and never forgot about the sparrow flying in through the banqueting hall, sailing in through the door from the night outside. For a brief snatch of a moment, a blast of noise and colour, light and warmth, maybe 3-4 wing beats before it flies out again, back into cold and darkness. But of what went before this life, or of what follows, we know nothing. Good night, then, said Mark, swaying and staring. No, not tonight. Good night, she said, and listened to him stumble down the narrow servant stairs. She lay in bed and heard the batterings of wings like blood beating in her head. She felt her cold toes curl into themselves as if they were tired of being feet, tired of walking, and a sleek hard ache singing in her arms like she'd been flying so far and so fast she'd gone past the last of the land. There was only the throb of the sea now, the moon on clouds. Where was she going? Infinity? Beyond? Who knew? A dark shape against a cloud flickered and gone, the martlet flying forever, en avant. Even now, she could convince herself that the wild flapping like a bird trapped in her chest was only that and nothing more. That the flashing sheen of the darkness was not black feathers spreading before her. That the tremulous weight on her belly was nothing but wine and loneliness. That the thing moving up her body, waddling a little, stump by stump, lightly kneading her sternum and breasts, was a dream, like last night, like so many nights. The emptiness made solid in the dark. Her overworked heart thrummed like wings. She opened her mouth to scream or to caw and tasted feathers.
Thank you, Lo. Before the final story of the evening, some notices. Unlike the Apollo missions, we'll be back at the Phoenix in August for women and girls. Women writers writing female protagonists on any theme they damn well like. The deadline is July the 7th, so get cracking. Check the Lyre's website for details along with the rest of 2019's themes and the near infinite library of telemetry from previous missions. And so, the final story of the evening will be Frozen Futures by Rhys Timson, read by Tony Bell. Rees is a writer who lives in London. His stories have been published by 3AM, Litro, Popshot, and the London Magazine, among other places. Evening Standard Award nominee for A Man for All Seasons, Tony Bell, has performed all over the world with award-winning all-male Shakespeare company, Propeller, playing Bottom, Autolycus, and Tranio. TV includes Coronation Street, Holby City, Midsummer's Murders, EastEnders, and The Bill. He's also a radio and voiceover artist. Tony!
Shortly before he turns 35, Tony decides to have his head frozen after he dies. Frozen isn't the right word. Vitrified is the word, but he's not really sure what that means. His whole body would have been preferable, but it's too expensive. Besides, he's confident that future scientists will be able to regrow his body using the cells from his head, like a seed grows a tree. Or else he'll be granted a robotic body with titanium bones and wiry sinews like Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator, the T-800, but with a human brain. He doesn't tell his wife, partly because he knows she'll think he's crazy, and partly because when he thinks about the future, he doesn't really see her. He sees hoverboards and flying cars and underwater cities and 3D video billboards showing Japanese women applying cherry red lipstick. What he doesn't see is his wife, or his two children, or a semi-detached house in Guildford with black mould on the bathroom ceiling and a dishwasher that gets clogged up with bits of pasta every few weeks. And besides, his marriage vows said, "Till death do us part." So he arranged to meet Angus from Frozen Futures in the lobby of his local Premier Inn. He wears dark glasses just in case anyone sees him. They sit down together over coffee and blueberry muffins, and Angus explains how it works, because it definitely works. When it comes to Tony's time to depart this life, a team from Frozen Futures will get to the scene as quickly as possible and prepare him for his journey, Angus says. He'll have to wear a wristband, Angus tells him, in case none of the people he has notified of his plan are nearby when he dies. Tony doesn't like the idea of jewellery, never been comfortable with anything close to his skin, but this is medical. Doctor's orders, he says. "I'm not a doctor," Angus says. Once he's declared dead, the team will get to work. They'll take him in a special ambulance to a warehouse outside Milton Keynes, where his blood will be replaced with medical-grade antifreeze. Then his head will be detached from his body and dunked in liquid nitrogen until science has caught up with him. There's a stack of documents to read and forms to fill in. Tony looks each one up and down as if he already has the super-fast reading skills he will no doubt have in the future, like his eyes are scanners that take nanoseconds to process every page. He scratches his autograph into the last of the many boxes and goes in for a high five. "We're both going to live forever," he says. Angus nods and meets Tony's palm, following a slight pause. "I can't believe it's so cheap," Tony says. "Why isn't everyone doing this?" "One thing," Angus says, "you must make sure your head isn't damaged when you pass. So try to avoid dying in a car crash or a plane crash or falling into a piece of industrial machinery. And whatever happens, don't get lost at sea." Mental note, Tony says, do not get lost at sea. After he signs the contract with Frozen Futures, Tony starts to look at life differently. What's the point in lowering my salt intake when the future people can fix it? Why stop smoking when I'll get new lungs? What's the point in saving for that once-in-a-lifetime trip to Tokyo? Imagine how much cooler that city will be in the year 3000! Also, sod the vacuuming. He says to his wife, "Sod the vacuuming!" But she doesn't understand. She's disturbed by his newfound happiness. She must suspect I'm having an affair, he thinks. And then he mutters to himself, "I am having an affair. I'm having an affair with the future, a tryst with immortality." He snickers to himself as he runs the Dyson up and down the living room carpet, the machine rattling like a power drill as it sucks up a child's toy. It's a few weeks before his wife sees the bracelet. She asks him what's it for, and he tells her. She's shocked and then perplexed. He watches her reaction and imagines himself as a cyborg he will someday become. His banal human vision replaced by a heads-up display with various charts and graphs showing key data about his surroundings, perhaps a crosshair centred on his wife's face and a flashing sign identifying her as hostile. Tony and his wife separate soon after. And as the years go by, the kids stop calling and he stops calling them, but it doesn't matter. He knows he has eternity to find someone new, to have a whole new family. He'll have infinity chances to do it all over again, and in the future, people will finally understand him. He will finally feel like he belongs. It happens 20 years after he signed up to Frozen Futures. He's doing some Christmas shopping. It's tiring him out. He's been up and down the high street, taking things off shelves, putting them back. Taking things off shelves, putting them back. He's buying for a grandchild he's never met. Do kids still like Buzz Lightyear? Can you still buy Buzz Lightyear? Why am I obsessing about Buzz Lightyear? He collapses onto the polished floor of the toy store. He drops his shopping bags and grabs his left shoulder. His arms feel numb. Someone is squeezing on his ribcage with a vice. So, this is it. To infinity and be. In truth, it's a bit like an orgasm. A very lonely orgasm. There's no real gap in his subjective experience. No feeling of waking from a long sleep. It's just like two ends of a film reel sewn rudely together. He can't see anything at first, but then his vision starts to return. It begins with coloured blotches, red and yellow smudges blooming in and out of the dark. They spread and join up. There are no lines, no definition. It's like turning the brightness up too high on the television. The world is filtered out with light. But gradually, it begins to settle. And he sees a tiled floor and two pairs of human legs. Why is his head on the floor? Guys, he wants to say, what am I doing on the floor? But he can't speak. He doesn't have a mouth. Then he hears a beep and he feels a sudden urge to pick up dirt. It's a weird feeling, not one he's had before, but despite having something like freedom of thought, he really doesn't have freedom of movement. The desire to pick up dirt is forced, not a matter of personal choice. He rolls forward, and what he realises are a number of small rotable wheels. The bare legs part, he trundles past them, sucking up a couple of grains of rice and flakes of human dermis with some high-powered suction hoses connected to whatever it is that's holding up his head. It's not until he reaches the opposite side of the room and comes face to face with a metal cabinet that he fully accepts this new reality. Looking at his reflection, he sees he's been parted from his head, but there's just a brain in a glass dome sitting atop a plastic base unit. There are wires and electrodes streaming out of his cerebrum, and although he has no real desire to do it, he feels an irresistible urge to make that cabinet shine like the burning heart of the sun. Over the next few days, these urges become stronger. Tony tries to fight them, but they're impossible to resist. He has a huge array of hoses and brushes at his disposal, and he puts them to work, sucking up dirt from even the narrowest of nooks. He doesn't enjoy it, but he can't help doing it. All he sees of the people around him are their legs. He attempts to run into them just to make a connection, but he always swerves out of the way, no matter how hard he tries. He thinks about ways to communicate. Obviously, these people don't know what they've got trundling around them on their floors. They think I'm brain dead, a vegetable, just some kind of organic computer. They don't realise I'm alive down here. If they knew, I'd have that new body and I'd be living the life. I'd be a global phenomenon. I'd be basking in the warmth of my accumulated wealth and fending off those future cheekers with a pole. This mysterious man from the past. If only they knew, they'd set me free. I'm not property. I'm people. But meanwhile, there's a grain of rice over there. Fetch. As the days pass, he develops more control over his new body. He's able to choose when to use the crevice tool or when to use a dusting brush. He develops a sense of when his dirt reservoir is approaching capacity. He stops in front of one of his human captors and tries some crude sign language with his main suction hose and the extension wand, but the stranger above him merely clucks and moves away. He returns to his charging station, despondent, sits in the dark, lets his mind wander. He doesn't sleep anymore, but his brain approaches a state of unfocused consciousness that is not dissimilar. He feels himself floating upwards towards the ceiling. Then he's flying over a forest of neon, above a skyscraper canopy that penetrates the clouds. He flies on, and the city drops away and is replaced by the winding streets and boxy semi-detached of English suburbia. He floats towards the back garden of one of those houses, sees a metal love seat and a corner rockery, and he realises this is the house he lived in, with his wife and his children, the place he used to call home. He's flying in through the back door when the charging station emits a loud beep, full battery, and he's back to his wakeful state. He feels overcome with grief, but he cannot cry. Instead, his metal body shakes violently with the suppressed emotion, and several flakes of dust are flung back out of his hoses. That gives him an idea, and with it a sudden surge of hope. He trundles over to a clean patch of floor and concentrates on trying to force his suction hoses into reverse. It's difficult. Everything about his new body resists him, but he keeps pushing. He feels the strain as if he were lifting a heavy weight, but then a column of detritus shoots from his mechanical body. He writes the word, "Help!" in the dust. The letters join together like skywriting, and then he sits and he waits. Some hours later, the lights come on and legs appear. A series of high chirrups follows, like birdsong, and two hands reach down and lift him from the floor. He's carried by a tall, slender body, wrapped in some kind of silver toga, and placed on a high surface. A monstrous face looms before him, human but only just. The skin is translucent, the eyes are as big as golf balls, it is entirely hairless. It looms at him, this face, and warbles incomprehensibly. Some kind of glowing tool clasped in its spidery fingers. His captor shakes its head and removes the glass dome covering Tony's brain. Tony doesn't feel anything as the whirring tool is driven into him. Segments of his brain are sliced off, and a column of white smoke rises from the pared flesh. Tony thinks of his wife. He thinks of his children. And a moment after that, he can think of nothing at all.
Tony. And that brings our epic voyage to an end. As you emerge from the still smoking crater and bravely set foot on the alien planet that is Oxford Street, remember, we'll be back here in 2 moons' time. Until then, stick around if you can and boldly go if you can't. But either way, please give it up for our stellar authors and our out-of-the-world actors. Good night!